Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC LP 105.3 FM, Troy, and WOOS LP 98.9 FM Schenectady, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Erica.
And I'm Elena. Tonight we go to Rome, New York, where members of Utica abolitionists were arrested at an anti-police brutality protest. We speak with Alyssa Bolt, who was arrested alongside Juan Gonzalez and WOOC reporter Brennan Maslaukas-Dunn. Then we have an episode of the Triple E's, where H. Bosch Jr. speaks with New York City Judge Harriet Thompson about the role of the surrogate court system.
After that, we travel with Hudson Mohawk Magazine Network roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry to the third installment of the Underground Railroad Educational Center book reads Black Reconstruction in America, 1860 to 1880 by W.E.B. Du Bois. Next, we hear from WOOC producer Elizabeth Press, who speaks to Justice Dazzle about Transgender Day of Remembrance.
Finally, Paul Smith attends the final public hearing for the Albany County Legislature's budget process via Zoom. But first, some headlines.
Albany County now has 29 residents hospitalized due to COVID, its highest number since April. 43 residents tested positive on Wednesday. Rensselaer County reported 3 new deaths, including 2 at the county nursing home, along with 21 new cases.
The National Rifle Association has agreed to pay $2.5 million civil penalty for violating state insurance laws when, without an insurance license, it promoted policies to protect gun owners from the legal consequences stemming from shooting a person in self-defense. In addition to the fine, the NRA is banned from marketing insurance in the state or receiving compensation from newly issued New York insurance policies for 5 years.
State advocates and lawmakers are urging Governor Cuomo to sign bills that target issues that have disproportionately harmed communities of color and immigrant communities. The bills include the Protect Our Courts Act, Driver's License Suspension Reform Act, Contact Tracing Confidentiality Act, and Proximity Bill.
The day after Christmas, 12 million Americans will lose their jobless benefits unless Congress acts. President-elect Joe Biden has called for Congress to extend the programs.
As reported in the Times Union, revised data for an audit examining possible racial bias within the city of Albany's police department added roughly 9,500 more arrests and showed Black residents make up a slightly higher percentage of arrests than previously reported. The new information also added more than 100 resisting arrest charges over a five-year-old period to the audit. CNA, the firm paid $80,000 for the audit, was forced to correct the information on arrests after a sharp-eyed observer noted the audit's data didn't match up with what the department reported to the state. Both city auditor Dorsey Appliers, who hired the firm, and CNA said the error did not change the findings in the report.
Schenectady Police Chief Eric Clifford announced that a use of force study is complete and ready for the Police Reform Steering Committee to review, and a draft of the police force's updated use of force policy based on recommendations from the state and Lexipol, a California-based private company, will also be available for the panel to scrutinize.
For those of you just tuning in, you are listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine coming to you from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy.
To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or follow us on Instagram or Twitter at Media Sanctuary and on Facebook at facebook.com/mediasanctuary.
Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Brendan Dunn interviewed Alyssa Bolt, who is a member of the activist group, the Utica Abolitionists. She was brutalized and arrested by police at an anti-police brutality protest in Rome, New York on October 2nd. Bolt was arrested alongside Juan Gonzalez, as well as reporter Brendan Dunn. The activists are called the Rome 3 and are currently facing potentially up to 2 years in jail over their charges.
So this was about the fourth or fifth protest that I had attended in the Rome, Utica area since I moved to this area back in July. We gathered at Fort Stanwix, major landmark in downtown Rome, to have a few speeches from people who'd been affected by an act of police brutality the night before, where a police officer was caught on camera beating up a 15-year-old boy who sustained some significant injuries, actually. We expressed concern that the Rome police force is acting out of control and has done several things over the summer and fall that give us great cause for concern as local citizens. So then we marched to the Rome Police Department, stood out front, preparing to list our demands for a reasonable, independent investigation. But before we could even begin to state our requests, we discovered that there was a sprinkler in the bushes in front of the station that was watering a large area of the sidewalk and plaza in front of it. We decided to gather anyway and just try to avoid getting splashed by it. But one young man who attended the protest, Juan Gonzalez, decided that he would go over and grab the sprinkler and point it into the bushes away from the building and try to unscrew it so that it wasn't spraying all over the sidewalk. Although this in itself really seems like an innocent act that I would imagine an elderly, cranky, concerned citizen would get away with easily enough, the police who were hiding around the side of the building used that as an excuse to charge at the protest. They acted completely over the line aggressively. They pushed and shoved people, and they grabbed one and were beginning to throw him to the ground. I was right next to him, so I decided I would grab him to keep him from being thrown to the ground, and I help him stay on his feet. I was afraid that this would become another case of police brutality and that he might get seriously hurt. I should also point out that Juan is a short-statured young man who is considerably vulnerable to assault from much larger officers. As soon as I did this, I was myself grabbed and thrown to the ground, threatened with being tasered, although not informed in words that I was being arrested, and promptly cuffed and dragged into the station, which is the last I saw for over an hour of what was going on outside the station, though I'm told people continued to chant in support of the three of us who were then taken into custody.
I was out at the protest with you that night, and as you recall, I was mostly taking pictures, filming things, and recording the events as they unfolded. I was pretty terrified when I saw the police come to attack the crowd out of nowhere. You know, one man was pushed to the ground. I saw them attack you, and that's when I started filming things. When they dragged you into the police department, I ran up closer to film the altercation, you know, that the police started. And next thing I knew, the police had their hands on my back, were yelling at me to stop resisting arrest, which I wasn't. And next thing I knew, I was thrown to the ground with the police officers kneeling on me. Can you talk about what happened next when we were all in the precinct?
So they put the three of us in separate rooms, and they at least handcuffed me to the wall. They had this one really unpleasant officer, Matthew Heinrich, who went out of the way to misgender me after I corrected him when he called me he repeatedly. And, I mean, I'll admit, I was pretty fired up. I was pretty wound up. They never read me my Miranda rights, so I was saying a few things that I might not have ordinarily said to a police officer under most circumstances, but not incriminating myself because I really hadn't done anything. Officer Heinrich got pretty frustrated with me and looked like he was about to lose his cool, so his commanding officer, whose name unfortunately I don't remember, actually asked him to go step away and just cool his temper down for a bit and took over his position of standing watch over me. I remember just being cuffed to the wall for quite a long time, first with my hands behind my back, which was really uncomfortable, and then they at least let me put my hands in front of me. You know, they took fingerprints, took a mugshot, made me sit there for a lot longer time, asked me a few questions. I answered the ones that I felt like I really legally had to answer, name, address, date of birth, but then they started trying to ask me more about my life history, everywhere I've lived, and I've lived in a lot of places around the country and around the world, honestly, so I didn't want to get into all that with them. I didn't feel like that was really something I legally had to tell them all right there and then. They got the impression that I had recently moved from Washington State, which is actually my birthplace, but a place I haven't lived in over 30 years. I didn't go out of the way to really hammer that out exactly, because they don't need to know the whole story about every bit of my complicated, weird life. I just remember eventually they handed me a couple of pieces of paper with charges on them and sent me outside. The crowd cheered. I pumped my hands in the air, grabbed the megaphone, and announced that I was going to be running for Congress on a platform including police reform and eventually police abolition.
Can you just talk a little more about what was going on outside of the police department when we were on the inside?
So as far as I know, like, inside the station, I could hear chanting and cheering going on from outside. So, like, I knew there were still people out there supporting us. I knew there were people who believed in our innocence and wanted us released. I heard the words, let them go, being chanted several times. When I came out, there were still a good number of people out there. I understood some people had gone home. It had been a long time, but there were still enough people out there to have some critical mass going. We had members of the Utica abolitionists leading chants and slogans, and yeah, there was a pretty enthusiastic crowd of mostly very young people, people in their late teens, early 20s, out there chanting and expressing their support for the three of us.
And this is, I'd like to add, this is Rome, New York, so I know things have been heating up over the summer just in terms of activism. So I feel like what happened, you know, having been in Rome and around Rome most of my life, you know, these kinds of protests and actions are very, very unheard of in Rome. At least they have been for decades now at this point. I did want to ask you just about the charges that everyone's facing. I think the good news that we recently heard was Juan Gonzalez thankfully had his one charge of tampering dropped, which is a very good sign. But the two of us are still facing charges of obstruction and resisting arrest, and the additional one of tampering on my part. So, you know, we went to court for our first appearance, but what do you hope will happen, and what's the plan going forward in terms of the legal process?
Yeah, what I'm hoping will happen is that within the next few days, I'll get a call from my attorney, Stephen Lockwood, telling me that my charges have been dropped too, because honestly, that's pretty ridiculous that they would even think of charging me with something when the only thing that they're even saying that I did, which I didn't even try to do, was prevent the arrest of someone else who's now not being charged. And the truth is, I wasn't even trying to stop an arrest. I was trying to prevent a violent beating. So the case against me is incredibly flimsy, especially now with those charges against Juan Gonzalez dropped, that I can't really imagine any sane prosecutor is going to continue to press this case. But I don't know if I really have all that much faith that this will go quickly. I feel like the police are going to put pressure on them to drag this out as long as possible just to mess with us, because that seems like the kind of thing that they do these days. Worst comes to worst, there will be another court appearance sometime in early 2021, and I'm absolutely going under maintaining my innocence because I really did not do anything illegal, and I should not be facing these charges, which are completely uncalled for.
Yeah, and the slow wheels of so-called justice continue to inch forward bit by bit. I did want to bring it back just for a moment. You know, if you could comment on maybe just a few of the things that have happened over the summer, to your knowledge, just in terms of the Rome Police Department and, you know, what number of residents have called the police as being unhinged, out of control, and some folks have even, you know, called them, you know, particularly racist, violent, and even acting like a cartel, I've heard from some folks. So I don't know if you know as much about the other incidents that have happened over the summer.
I know something. I will be honest, I am not from this area at all. I just moved here in July. I'd never been to the Mohawk Valley until this summer. So I first got involved in politics in early September. I mean, involved in activism around here, because up to that point, I'd been waiting to get my legally changed, updated name on my ID so that if anything like this did go down, I would get charged as myself and not under a dead name that I don't even identify with. So that means I was not really around for some of the other things they've done, but I understand that there have been actions where white supremacists were threatening people and the police did not take this seriously, and if anything, seemed to be siding with the racists instead of with the people who they were going after. That's really all I know about events prior to early October.
You just heard Alyssa Bolt, who was arrested alongside Utica abolitionist members while protesting police brutality in Rome, New York, reported by Brendan Dunn.
Triple E's host H. Boss Jr. speaks with NYC's Judge Harriet Thompson. In December 2019, Judge Harriet Thompson was inducted to the Surrogate Court of Kings County with almost 40 years of law experience behind her, working as an attorney since 1982 and a judge since 2011. Judge Thompson also talks about how the position of surrogate court judge can often be overlooked, but plays a big role in the community.
Hello again, everyone. This is H. Bosch Jr. with another segment of the Triple E's Education, Empowerment, Entrepreneurship. Today's guest is the Honorable Judge Harriet Thompson. Judge Thompson was elected to the judicial position of Kings County, Brooklyn, New York in 2018, where she is one of two judges presiding over estate and probate matters. Please go to the Sanctuary for Independent Media website to see Judge Thompson's complete bio. This is part one of a two-part segment. So let me start out by saying, giving you a great big old Triple E's Overcoming Adversity Specialist. Welcome, Judge. Welcome.
Thank you so much. Good afternoon. What a pleasure it is to be with you.
Well, thank you so much. So I just want to go right into it, okay? Why did you become a lawyer?
Well, as a student for a long time, I really wanted to be a doctor.
Okay.
And when I fainted, when they cut the frog, I think it was in the seventh grade, I knew that my aspirations for being a doctor were shot. And most children in my age back in that time, right, went to Washington, D.C. as a field trip. I go there and I saw a woman arguing before the Supreme Court of the United States of America. And I was so
impressed. Wow.
Said, I'm going to do that one day. And I'll say one more minor thing. I really needed to understand what the legal system was about, particularly in regards to minorities and how we were looked at in the law and in other parts of our judicial system.
And how old were you at that particular time?
Oh, I was, oh God, junior high school, what? I think we're just teens, maybe 12, 13.
Bless your heart.
Found that my mother ever allowed me to stay away from home. I can remember that. It was the first time I ever went away from being in the little nest of Juanita Beard, my mom.
Great, great. So what motivated you to leave practice and seek to be elected, you know, judge? I mean, that was a real daunting task and a leap of faith.
Absolutely. Well, practicing law gives us a myopic perspective. And I felt that becoming a judge would really give me an opportunity to have a panoramic point of view of the judiciary. And when you really have worked as long as I did, about 18 years, it's a grind. It's not easy, and particularly when you do it as a solo, which obviously you have a partner, but if you were handling all of this by yourself, it could really be a daunting task. You need to do your business.
Absolutely.
Being an African-American woman in private practice, there was some rigors to that that I was willing to give up once a position in the civil court became available. So I decided to run. I thought I had the goods. I thought I had
the chops.
I had the ability to do the job. And that's where I went for it.
So what were your duties as a civil court judge?
Oh, that's a vast job.
And so briefly, because we got plenty of other questions.
So the people can understand the civil court is the people's court. That is where all of the essential issues of life can hit you. One, small claims court, where you sue for monies or injuries, monetary injuries under $5,000. Your eviction proceedings are there. Non-payment, when you don't pay the rent versus a holdover, when your landlord seeks to recover possession. We also have there the utility companies, right? Some people lose their meters in the utility companies, right?
Wow.
We have kind of seizures. We also have our debt collection. So all the credit card debts are dealt with through that. Any civil court matter where the injuries are less than $25,000 are sued for in that court. Dog bites, contractual disputes, commercial disputes between commercial, residential, getting back your security deposit, no fault litigation, general litigation, mm-hmm. jury trials, non-jury trials. So you see, this is the big court that really directly affects your life as every ordinary citizens, everyday citizens, actually.
So what made you decide to jump up to or describe your duties, the duties of a surrogate then?
That's a big one.
Mm-hmm.
The surrogate court.
So chop it down because we got a lot of other questions.
Okay, the surrogate court is a very, very, very specialized court. Just like each one of us could say, well, we know what the Supreme Court does, criminal, the Supreme Court civil, we know some medical malpractice, et cetera. But the surrogate deals with this. It is the determination and the distribution of real property, that's co-op, shares, condo, because that's a kind of ownership.
Okay.
Transfer of any property that you own, things, your artwork, your car. Those are the things that we determine. We also determine the distribution of real property. Like I said, condominiums, houses, buildings. We also can allow others in other states, when someone dies here in our county, in Kings, we allow them to do what's called ancillary proceedings, giving them permission to sell that type of property in the county of Kings.
Wow. You know what?
A lot. Now, that's the land of the dead. I didn't deal with the part that we deal with, the living.
Okay. All right. Touch on that.
We can talk a lot about the surrogate.
Okay. And then we're going to come back for part two. I want you to hang around. Okay. All right.
Very good. Thank you.
Okay. Real quick, tell me, because, you know, I love your career and you're just a trailblazer. Tell me some of your mentors in high school and in college, all right? You know.
Well, I think my main mentor was a woman by the name of Lillian Roth. She was my guidance counselor in Walt Whitman High School. And one of the things that she said to me, she says, the reason why you're going to be successful is you can be in both worlds. And I know what she meant by that.
What did she mean?
She meant that I could deal with my African-American community and I could deal with the other communities of which I know that I would be a part of. And she always gave me encouragement there to balance yourself because you're going to need to understand and deal in both worlds because there's going to be that world of your own and then you're going to deal with the other real world where it's primarily men, right? That wasn't me. I wasn't a man. And they were of either Caucasian or other, if you will. And she made me very much aware at a very young time how important it was to be able to balance. So that was my first mentor. My second mentor, I would say, was in college, Dennis DeLong, who was one of my professors in SUNY. I went to the system, SUNY at Plattsburgh.
Mm-hmm.
And then I believe in law school, it was the books and the judges in the books that were writing that became my mentors as I navigated learning how to analyze and write cases. I didn't do a lot of hornbook law like some people did. I really read those cases. And I found that some of them were my mentors. There was a few very good professors that I liked, Professor Timon. One of them you may even know was out of St. John's. Why can't I call his name? David Siegel.
Okay.
One who wrote New York Practice, big treatise on practicing law in the state of New York. He was one of my mentors.
Real quick, and you know, we got to give a shout out to Linda Marie, okay?
All right. Yes.
Your friend, your lifetime friend.
Yes, have been a friend since I laid eyes on her.
Yeah. So tell me real quick.
She's not a mentor too, but she's been that too.
I think absolutely. Yes.
Both admired each other in many different ways.
Right. So real quick, how did you navigate the male-dominated court system, judges, you know, the good old boys network. You know, I know that must have been a challenge in itself.
Yes, it was. As a matter of fact, I'll never forget the first time I was in Supreme Court as an attorney. And, you know, I was suited down, high heels, bang. And it was what's called the camp conference. That's the kind of conference that they hold before you could go forward and perfect an appeal, which means you're going to the appellate division, close to our Court of Appeals, the highest court in our state. And I got there and we're in the meeting and the judge looks at me and he says, when is your lawyer going to come in? And I said, I'm the lawyer judge.
Wow, isn't that
funny? Blew his mind. Yeah. And, you know, he apologized.
You knew what school of thought that was coming from.
Yes, and you have to understand that many of those judges were just like him. There were very, very, very few African Americans, period. Nonetheless, women that were practicing in the Supreme Court in the early 90s.
We can officially take a break, okay? And we're going to come back for part two. All right? You going to hang around, Judge?
I certainly will.
I am so excited. I'm as giddy as a kid in a candy store, right? I want you to dance like there's no one watching, sing like there's no one listening, love like you've never been hurt, and you better live like it's heaven on earth. Until next time, folks, don't hear about making a difference. You need to be about making a difference. This is Inez Bosch's baby boy and your overcoming adversity specialist doing what I'm made to believe.
You just heard H. Bosch Jr. in conversation with Judge Harriet Thompson of New York City on the Triple E's.
For those of you just tuning in, I'm Erica.
And I'm Elena. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, questions, suggestions, or a sour bone to pick with us, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. On Friday, November 13th, Hudson Mohawk Magazine Network Roman Labor Correspondent Willie Terry attended the Zoom Underground Railroad Educational Center book reads Black Reconstruction in America 1860 to 1880 by W.E.B. Du Bois in this part one of five segments. You will hear the study group discuss chapter 9, The Prince of Disaster, of the 746-page book, the UREC founders, Paul and Mary Liz Stewart, moderate the discussion, part three.
Yeah, Willie, what was your thought? I know this is a discussion question, and obviously we're looking for all sorts of things, but I was particularly interested in your question about similarities that Johnson and Trump shared in their impeachment process. And I wasn't quite so sure about that. Maybe you could, can you?
But was impeaching Trump for, what do you call it? Just look at it. But misdemeanor.
Oh, high crimes and misdemeanor.
High crime and misdemeanor.
Surely.
Right? And that's what Johnson was impeached for.
Yeah, but I mean, that's in the Constitution. I mean, that's what they're supposed to be impeaching people for. And I think that it's my understanding that that's one of the problems with the Constitution is that they didn't define what those were. So. And it is also very interesting, given the fact that a president has a degree of immunity from prosecution for a range of things, that the only way then to prosecute him is to impeach him, which I think is pretty unfortunate, considering that, you know, it's a pretty high bar to impeach somebody.
Wait, and he didn't get impeached. I mean, they went into the procedure of impeachment, but he didn't get impeached. So
right.
Both of them went into that procedure, but they didn't get impeached. They were saved.
Yeah.
It was a Kansan that gave the final vote. His son's buried in a cemetery less than 2 miles from where my home is.
For Johnson, yeah.
Yeah, for Johnson. It was a Kansan that basically said no.
Now, he didn't get convicted by one vote, right?
Yeah, he was off by one vote, and the decider was a gentleman. For some reason, his surname escapes me, but it was the senator from Kansas that basically made the deciding vote. Johnson had all kinds of problems with alcoholism, and that senator did not get reelected. He basically got sent out on a rail out of Kansas.
Really?
Mm.
Wow.
He was definitely persona non grata. There was such strong feelings, at least in Kansas, or at least northeastern Kansas.
Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, as far as Trump is concerned, I mean, that's one of the shortcomings of the impeachment process is that it's in a sense a high bar to convict somebody, and the idea of high crimes and misdemeanors is not well defined, so that means that, you know, like in Trump's case where 49 of the senators were Republicans, or was it 51? At any rate, they had 51 votes.
They needed a supermajority because of that change in the law.
Right.
That Democrats had done several years ago.
Yeah. So, and in a sense, the same, you know, it's just that whole Ukraine thing, I think, was very, you know, it was obvious that he was attempting to put the squeeze on Ukraine in order to get some political gain from it.
So do you think, was Johnson trying to get political gain in what he was doing?
Johnson, the concern of the Republicans in relation to Johnson was that he had rejected several of their laws, several laws that were being brought forward, vetoed them. The Congress felt that these laws were the will of the people, and Johnson had rejected them. So that's a little different, I think. I don't know what you other folks think, but I thought it seemed to me that that's different from what happened with Trump.
I mean, there were several people that talked about impeaching Lincoln just because, you know, we'd always said that the Union was a voluntary, and he's the one that kept everybody in the Union, too. I mean, there was a lot of talk that Lincoln should have been impeached.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm saying this because I'm a Lincoln descendant, too. I'm a fifth-generation grandfather was Mordecai, his oldest uncle. But that was always interesting. He had the same ability to tell stories and stuff, but the idea of that Lincoln actually survived without being impeached to me is an interesting, you know, from what I've read, kind of an interesting concept.
Sure.
Well, I know the Du Bois' treatment of Lincoln in a previous chapter, I appreciated because it seemed to, as Du Bois was portraying Lincoln, there seemed to be chinks in the armor. We've had occasion over the years to rub elbows with some Lincoln scholars who are really enamored with Lincoln and, you know, raise him up as this great model. And I always get nervous about, you know, around people like that. I was like, okay, fine. You know, I don't have the knowledge to challenge, you know, that sort of portrayal. So when I got into reading Du Bois's portrayal of Lincoln, I thought, well, here's the data. Here's the data to illustrate, Lincoln was not the great saint that he's often, in the way which he's so often portrayed.
The person that gave Lincoln humanity helped Lincoln to finally see a person of color not only as his intellectual and moral equal, but also above him was Frederick Douglass, in my opinion. Lincoln always looked at slavery as an issue of
whether or not someone would get the fruits of their labor. He did not look at Native Americans or African Americans as equals. It was Frederick Douglass, and I'm Du Bois. I also think probably that Ludham, but particularly Frederick Douglass and Mrs. Ketley, to say, you know, that, you know, these are people that are my equal, if not my superiors, in terms of intellect and moral equivalent.
Here's a paragraph, page 336, that really struck me about the book. And this is when we think about the role of the Constitution and what was the United States, et cetera. And he says here, certainly no one could argue that the founders contemplated civil war to preserve the Union, or the Constitution was a pro-slavery document. Yet unconstitutionally, the South made it a pro-slavery document, and unconstitutionally, the North prevented the destruction of the Union on account of slavery, and after war, revolutionary measures rebuilt what revolution had disrupted and formed a new United States on the basis broader than the old Constitution and different from its original conception. I thought, to me, that's sort of like it, you know, put things in a framework different than what I had imagined it before. You know, it's one of those things that, you know, from time to time, like even in current times, you know, you think about the Secret Service and the various people, members of the cabinet, et cetera. We swear allegiance to the Constitution, not to the president. So, you know, in this case, you know, the Constitution is sort of like, well, what is the Constitution? And even this even strikes me in terms of Supreme Court decisions. You know, people sit around and say, well, I'm an originalist and I read the Constitution in its context, et cetera. And yet the Constitution is, and of necessity, the nature of it, what it is, what it means, had to have changed from before the Civil War and after the Civil War. You know, it's not the same document. Even though we have the same words on the paper, it's not the same document.
That was Hudson Mohawk Magazine Network's roaming labor correspondent, Willie Terry, with part three of the Underground Railroad Educational Center book reads, Black Reconstruction in America, 1860 to 1880 by W.E.B. Du Bois.
The Transgender Day of Remembrance was started in 1999 by transgender advocate Gwendolyn Ann Smith as a vigil to honor Rita Hester, a transgender woman who was killed. Now the Transgender Day of Remembrance is an annual observance on November 20th that honors the memory of the transgender people whose lives were lost in acts of violence. It occurs at the end of Transgender Awareness Week, a time to help raise visibility for transgender people. In this segment, WOOC producer Elizabeth Press speaks to Justice Dazzle about the Transgender Day of Remembrance.
The Transgender Day of Remembrance has been observed annually on November 20th as a day to memorialize those who have been murdered as a result of transphobia. Today, we are joined by Justice Dazzle to talk about the Transgender Day of Remembrance and its observance here locally. Justice, welcome to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
And Justice, you are with Schenectady Safe Space. Can you tell us about this organization and what you do?
We started just about a year ago, actually, in November of 2019. I had recently moved to Schenectady from Albany. I hadn't realized that there wasn't a Pride Center here in Schenectady. And so I reached out to a few different LGBT friends here in Schenectady and seeing if they'd be interested in trying to get our own Pride Center going. So over the last year, we have we've held a few events, although really only one in person, because the first event we held was in early February, and then the world shut down in early March. So basically, our focus is on having it be a safe space for everyone, as well as making it a fully accessible space, so that, you know, a teenager can come with their parents, somebody with autism or those types of sensory issues can come, and it's not, there's going to be a space where they can go, you know, so even if we're having a loud event, there's a space where they can go. Having it be physically accessible so that people with physical disabilities don't feel like they're kind of shut to the side or they can't go. And we partnered with Schenectady Pride to do a virtual / socially distanced Pride at the end of June. And we have started in May. We have been doing a virtual, it was going to be in person, LGBT and questioning support group. It initially was once a month, and we have moved that because of response. We've moved that to twice a month. So it is the second and fourth Thursday of every month from 6:30 to 8 p.m.
Great. You are collaborating again with the Schenectady Pride to hold a vigil to mark Transgender Day of Remembrance this coming Friday, November 20th. Before you tell us about that event, can you first tell us why it is important to have this day?
So the thing is like, New York is one of the safest places to be trans, mostly because, you know, New York passed a law called GENDA, which basically says that me being trans isn't a reason for me or my landlords to kick me out. I can't be fired for my gender identity. I am allowed to use the bathroom, no matter where it is, in the state that matches my gender identity, and I don't have to approve that to anybody or any of that type of thing. Whereas a lot of other places, that's not the case. New York is also only one of only 11 states that has banned the use of trans panic defense in court, which basically is you find out someone that you were interacting with, whether it was romantically, sexually, or just in your day-to-day life, is trans or gay, and you react violently, whether, you know, it's just assault or whether it's murder. And in 39 states, that is a valid legal defense that can potentially get the entire case thrown out, and you get no repercussions for your actions. You know, so what that leads to is a lot of trans people, primarily trans people of color, and the vast majority, trans women, Black trans women, get murdered. This year, the last count I saw was there were 35 up until this point, which is more than any other year since it's being tracked. You know, the most recent one I'm aware of was a woman who was walking home from work in Indiana, and she was brutally murdered. And that was less than a month ago. You know, and this was a white woman in the middle of Indiana who worked at a local store and had to walk less than a mile home. And, you know, and that's just the people that were actually identified as being trans. A lot of times family and the authorities will misgender and dead name that person in death. And so it may not even come up that that person was trans.
Justice Dazzle, thank you for that. This Friday, as Schenectady Safe Space and Schenectady Pride are hosting a vigil to mark Transgender Day of Remembrance. Can you tell us about the event that you're organizing in Schenectady?
Yeah, absolutely. So we're going to meet at the Rainbow Arches down at the Gateway Plaza, just off of the SUNY Schenectady's campus. It's going to be a candlelight vigil. Schenectady Pride has had this event at least the last year. So they have a collection of candles and votives and that type of thing. So we should have enough for everyone that shows up. And then we're going to take some time. I'm probably going to read some poetry of some trans people of color, have some time for people to talk about their experience and experiences with other trans people. Like I know at least one woman here in Schenectady, there's a friend of theirs that was really instrumental in them getting to a point of being able to come out as who they are. Take time and read the names of all of the people that are known to that were trans, non-binary, and gender nonconforming that were killed this year. And just take some time that's a lot of it is the visibility of trans people, you know, that all of these statistics, you know, the 41% suicide, which is a false number, you know, I mean, or it's said in the wrong way. You know, there are a lot of arguments about science and biology and all these types of things, even though tons of medical organizations, doctors, psychiatrists, all of these across the entire world have said what trans people have been telling us about themselves is in fact medically and psychologically and biologically correct. But there is a lot of fake science that gets touted. And so the actual data, the actual truth about us, most trans people are just want to be left alone, be able to go to school, go to work, be called their name, not be violently attacked, and live a happy life.
Thank you for sharing that, Justice Dazzle. So as we wrap up today, is there anything that you want to make sure that we cover? Or if not, could you talk about the significance of this vigil taking place at the Rainbow Arches?
Well, with the Rainbow Arches especially, I think this is, it's amazing. The fact that it's right in downtown Schenectady, you know, it's right at the gateway to the city. You know, it's right off of the college campus. It's right on State Street. So, you know, you're 2 minutes from Proctor's and you're right downtown. And the fact that the city and SUNY Schenectady have given that space. In addition, the Schenectady Foundation granted the money to be able to build that art installation. But the original art, in addition to the update this year, or to add the Progress Pride flag, to add the black and brown stripes, there is the artist, Ray Frazier, that did that originally, is a black person in the community, a black LGBT person in the community, that, you know, did amazing work with this. You know, there's knowledge to be learned, because there are placards there talking about each one of the colors and what they mean and what they mean for the current day, as well as the fact that, you know, Schenectady is open to it, having it in there, that they want it, us to be safer. They want us to be more accepted. And having that space, and having it be such a prominent space when you come into the city is a really great thing.
Justice Dazzle, thank you for joining us today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. This Friday marks the Trans Day of Remembrance, and to join Schenectady Safe Space and Schenectady Pride, look them up on Facebook.
Thank you so much.
That is this Friday, November 20th. Meet at the Schenectady Great Way Park at 7 p.m. for a candlelight vigil for Transgender Day of Remembrance. Municipalities have to pass their budgets for the coming year in November. Paul Smith and the Hudson Mohawk Magazine recently listened in to the final public hearing for the Albany County Legislature's budget process via Zoom, getting at the process as well as a bit of the nitty-gritty of budgeting.
Concurrent with the Halloween and election seasons, many of our municipalities have to also weigh and pass budgets for the coming year. How does this process unfold? We recently caught up with the final hearing in the Albany County Legislature's budget process, overseen by legislator Wanda Willingham of North Albany.
Good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Welcome to the Audit and Finance Committee 2021 Agency Budgets Review. Department heads, you will be asked a series of questions related to your budget and are expected to answer as completely as you can. If an answer to our questions cannot be provided at this time, then please indicate when you are able to provide it to the committee. Legislators have been provided with your written responses to our budget information request letter. And we absolutely thank you for your cooperation in providing them. However, in order to complete a more thorough examination of the budget, it may be necessary to forward you some additional questions after tonight's hearing. So this is the order that we will move in tonight, everyone. We are going to start with the Division of Management and Budget, which is Commissioner Thalen. Probation is Director William Connors. The Public Defender's Office, Judge Herrick. The Alternate Public Defender, Tina Sodi. County Attorney, Eugenia Condon. Immigration, Evelyn Kenna. And the Board of Elections, Commissioners Klein and Blady.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I basically would like to handle that in two parts because I believe we also have to talk about the summary of revenues and all the other items associated with that. So I have a brief presentation that gives the overview of the countywide budget, but I'll speak to the just the departments that are under my purview specifically now. There are no outstanding or positions requesting a greater than 2% raise in any of the finance, which operates our treasury function, our collections function, and we also have our real property branch, who follows, who was under Director Alex until her departure recently. And then we also have IT, which you had heard of from earlier in the week, I believe. So those were handled separately. As for a whole, I believe we have all the resources that we need for the upcoming year. As you know, we also operate a stabilization, and we call it stabilization and demolition department, but they actually handle our foreclosed properties and monitoring and maintaining them. Outside of any normal years, the Treasury Department also acts as the main fiscal arm for the county. The Collections Department handles the receipts and disbursements of sales tax, which is 40% of your revenue countywide. It also does another, on a good year, and next year will not be a good year, another $8 million in hotel occupancy tax that it disperses to its requisite departments as per the state share that it is inclined to follow those rules. And that's our departmental specifics. As you can see, the revenue for the proposed 2021 is $578 million, roughly. The adopted for 2020, compared to that, was $594 million. So that is a significant decrease. But the revenue totals for the 2021 proposed, you know, they account for $719 million in total. The $621 million of that is 0.8 is non-property tax revenue, and 97.5 of that is property tax revenue. That's your tax levy. In comparison, that's $16.4 million difference, or 2.76%. The levy growth of $2.1 million, or 2.27%, and the combined growth of minus $14 million.
I'm going to be late. Okay.
Or a growth of
there's early voting going on.
A decrease of 2% for overall revenues. The next part is part three, and that's our tax levy formula. This is the things that go into it. It's not as simple as a 2% or a 1.5%. There's a lot of factors on the levy calculation. The comparison of the last 5 years is on page four.
Yeah,
it's the last 6 years for this one. But as you can see, over this time, and actually for the last
Sean said it was
7 years,
we've Mr. Thalen. Yes, ma'am.
Hold on a moment.
So as you can see, the tax levy limit for 2021, which is in the bottom right hand corner, the total is $98,689,925. The proposed levy is $97,532,487. This growth was generated by a 0.59% growth in the tax cap reserve, in the tax base growth factor, and a 1.56 increase. Percent increase in the allowable levy growth factor, and that 1.15 or that 1.56%, that is what the state dictates as the tax cap number this year. It's the lesser of 2%, or your CPI growth. And as you can see, we've had less than, we're expected to have less than the 2% growth for next year. So the first time that that's happened in, the last 3 years, I think in 2018, you had a 1.84% growth factor. So piles have been forecasted flat, so you don't have anything to worry about in that regard. The difference between the proposed levy and the tax levy limit is 1.157 million. As you can see from the tax rate comparison, the tax rate has a slight decrease to the equalization value. Best way to judge of how we're actually doing, I believe, because we don't directly levy on people, we levy to the towns, and that goes, then it's passed on to the resident taxpayers. Here you can see our sales tax, 40% of our revenue for the county. And as you can see, this year has been not the best of years. We're forecasting it for 2021 at $272 million. This is approximately $18.3 million, or a 6.3% decrease over the 2020 budgeted amount. This projection reflects the impact of the COVID-19 and probably the continued economic conditions due to the COVID-19. Our regional unemployment rate is around 9% right now. You know, that's not where we like to be. We like to be around a, 4%. That's a natural unemployment for job turnovers. 9% means about double that. And that number was up to as high as 13-14% not so long ago. So as we all know, that's a number that can be kind of not a true economic indicator, as that's only the people that are filed for unemployment. That's not the people that have come off of an unemployment because they've exhausted their benefits at that point. So we look for that to hopefully increase or decrease to get back to that natural unemployment. But it, in the short term, it doesn't seem to be the case. Year-to-date collections for the second and third quarter of 2020 down compared to 2019. That number is 19.8 million right there. First quarter had a 4.5% growth over 2019, which was pretty good. Then the COVID hit. You had a 25.27% downturn for the third quarter, or for the second quarter, excuse me. And the third quarter was down 4.7% over the previous year. So as you can see, we haven't even gone to collect the previous years, let alone any kind of growth year over year. Distributions are 108.8 million budgeted to be distributed to the municipalities for 2021. That's down from 116 for 2020 budgeted. You're talking that cash flow to the counties, cities, and villages, being down over 8 million or a little less than 8%, 7.6%.
This has been Paul Smart reporting for Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
That was the Albany County Legislature final public hearing for the budget process.
And that concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Elena McGrath.
And I'm Erica. Our engineer tonight is Alexis Goldsmith. Remember to tune in every weekday to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose on demand through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. If you have comments, suggestions, or to comment on our work, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org.
As a reminder, the Hudson Mohawk Magazine is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in helping with our radio effort, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org. Or join our weekly virtual Zoom meetings on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m. by sending an email requesting an invitation link to hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.